Welcome to the East Traumacast. This program was brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Advancing science, fostering relationships, and building careers. Now, on to the Traumacast.
Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to Haemonetics for their generous and unrestricted grant for the Educational Resources Committee and Traumacast. I'm Tatiana Cardenas, a trauma, burns, and acute care surgeon at Del Seton Medical Center and Dell Medical School at UT Austin. Today, we're going to talk about critical care management for the burn patient. We have a very distinguished panel of guests and lots to talk about, so I'll let everyone introduce themselves.
Hi, everyone. My name is Samantha Terrace. I'm an acute care surgeon at Indiana University, and I'm excited to help co-moderate this trauma cast.
I'm Taryn Travis. I'm a burn surgeon in Washington, D.C. at MedStar Washington Hospital Center.
And I'm Matt Drake. I'm a burn and trauma critical care surgeon at Burn and Reconstructive Centers of America in Richmond, Virginia.
Well, welcome. Thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today. So let's cover a little bit about the difficult resuscitation and burn shock. And what is burn shock exactly? In the fall, I think, of 2022, we did a trauma cast solely dedicated to resuscitation. So I wanted to focus this question more on the difficult resuscitation, really diving into what burn shock is, when to use pressors, when to give boluses, how do you manage it, et cetera. So if we can start with that, that'd be great.
I think our understanding of burn shock is evolving, luckily, due to some of the great science that's happening in this space right now. And more, the community is starting to acknowledge how much endotheliopathy and endothelial damage plays a role in burn shock. And so when I talk to learners or first responders about it, I refer to this idea that we have to pour fluid into people to keep their intravascular space replete, and we're doing it through a sieve of sorts where all of that fluid is leaking right back out of that intravascular space. And so what is causing that, I think, has over the past 5 to 10 years become more and more apparent that has to do with endothelial damage and specifically the glycocalyx. And so managing burn shock warrants really attention to that. And that's a new way of thinking about the general problem.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I also think it's important to imply to people, whether you're the burn center taking care of patients with big burn injuries on the regular, or whether you're someone who is a trauma surgeon at a center that may not be necessarily definitive care for these patients, is that a burn resuscitation is a very dynamic process. It isn't just you calculate 4 cc's per kilo per percent body surface area. That's what the patient's going to get no matter what. It's an extremely dynamic process that is most likely the best when it's nourished and when you use a specific set of parameters, not just a single thing to try to figure out how patients are responding.
Okay. Mac, do you guys use decision support tools?
We do not use any commercially available software to navigate the burn resuscitation process. We do use an algorithm that is primarily nurse driven, and then we use a constellation of other things such as point-of-care ultrasound. We make sure that lactate clears, not necessarily reacting based on elevated lactate levels, but making sure that it clears. I'm also a big advocate of using invasive hemodynamic metrics like stroke volume variation, cardiac output, and devices that are available at the tips of arterial line. So in the big burn resuscitations, I find that just using the constellation of those things, in addition to urine output, which is probably the best thing about current practice.
Software that I was speaking about, Tatiana, is something that we adopted probably 4 or 5 years ago, was originally developed by the Department of Defense to try to manage burn resuscitations when people were being flown essentially from theater back to the States with an ongoing resuscitation. And it allowed the folks flying with the patients, who more often than not were not physicians, to be able to manage a burn resuscitation and to do so if they didn't have immediate physician decision support. And as Mac alluded to, it's not 100% necessary, but it's a nice tool to have, especially with either new to practice or new to burn nurses that don't have in the back of their mind how to titrate fluids for a burn resuscitation. And so we've adopted that to support some of our newer nurses. And it's a nice way to graphically look at how your resuscitation went. It'll show you fluids in versus fluids out and how often you were in the window that you were targeting and what you did to react to that. And it's been a great sort of QIPI thing for us to figure out how we're doing and how, for instance, Collide might make a difference to that or other things.
I've seen over the years, patients, you're resuscitating them and then all of a sudden they're needing pressors. What is your take on when you start pressors? What do you think about that? And then what do you think about that as a prognostic sign and in discussion with maybe family?
Never algorithmic for us. And I think that the danger with pressor is covering up malperfusion, right? The same way sometimes people think about giving bicarb, right? You're covering up what the problem is and making the numbers look better. And so you can give someone pressor and make their blood pressure look better and sometimes even make their urine output look better because you're perfusing the kidney in that moment, but you're not fixing the problem because you're still leaking and your intravascular space is not what it should be. So when we employ pressors, it's usually an unusual resuscitation, perhaps somebody with some background reason to not be able to the way that they should with resuscitation alone, be that somebody with pre-existing cardiac issues, other traumatic injury. Late arrival to the burn center can sometimes put you in that position, but it's never part of our routine in burn resuscitation.
Yeah, I agree. And personally, I would rather a patient have to go on vasopressors for hemodynamic support rather than someone get boluses every time a different provider walks by the room. And then I'm ending up, you know, with abdominal compartment syndrome or extremity compartment syndrome. Those are almost never events anymore in the burn ICU in the modern era. So for me, it's more like Taryn alluded, I is trying to figure out why this resuscitation is so difficult. Why is it going off the rails? Do they have an inhalation injury that I haven't diagnosed for whatever reason? But were they dehydrated when they came in? Do they have failure at baseline? Were they intoxicated? Do they have a traumatic injury that wasn't elicited during the pre-hospital or the initial workup phase? For me, my brain usually starts spinning to try to figure out why it's going off the rails so badly. In a large CDSA resuscitation, I don't really get that worked up about patients going on vasopressors for hemodynamic support at some level. And I find a lot of times that more of a sedative and analgesia related thing. So I think you just have to take the whole picture into account, use the data that's available, and just always keep questioning yourself, critical care team, about have we found everything that's at play?
Pressors to me usually mean something isn't going according to plan. It doesn't mean you can't use them, but that's usually one of these clues for me that I need to look under the hood and see what I might be missing. Cardiac function, yeah, et cetera.
They aren't part of the algorithm, but if somebody's had several titrations of fluids up, the nurses are scaling back the sedation, the analgesia, or they're trying to hold it. The patient's wiggly and uncomfortable, and the pressure is still an issue. Then all the things that Taryn's, look for something else, see what you're missing, see if there's anything you can optimize. But then we do use a colloid rescue protocol. So at the 8th hour, someone is on a vasopressor, or if we had to sequentially increase the volume of crystalloid that they're receiving that's calculated, then we add the colloid resuscitation onto that. Sometimes that helps. It's usually not a magic bullet. It's like you add on the albumin rescue and 2 hours later, boom, they're off of pressors completely. But I find it does decrease the overall dosage of the vasopressors by and large. Of course, burn wounds are going to usually suffer. All, you know, every tissue is going to suffer if you have to go into high dose phase usage. But some of these patients, I just come to expect that in a difficult resuscitation.
It seems as though urine output is really like the true north in being able, especially in these patients who come in late, for example, Taryn, that you mentioned, delayed admission to the burn center. It's a large burn. Maybe they're already 18 hours in and you've got to play catch up. It's interesting how urine output is the true north and really the only real endpoint that we've got.
Yeah, Mac mentioned a few moments ago that they follow lactate clearance. We essentially do the same thing with a different number. We use base excess and deficit on an ABG. And that's largely just because myself and my partners really like ABGs, and you can get so much data from a single lab. So if I had to pick one lab for any patient with any problem, it would always be an ABG. But yeah, we follow acid clearance as well. We just use base, excess, and deficit.
I give an acid-base talk every year, and every time I'm in the unit, I always give an acid-base talk. This ABG, I agree with you.
Favorite.
Oh my God, so good. Now, moving on from the difficult resuscitation and burn shock, along those lines, so chronologically, we've resuscitated or we're resuscitating our patient, and we're noticing that the urine output is downtrending. Their hemodynamics are okay, but the urine output is downtrending. Whatever your target is, it's not being maintained, whether it's above the line or above 0.5 cc's per kilo or whatever the bar is, and it just continues to go down and you're continuing to go up on resuscitation. What is your trigger for CRRT? Is it anuria? Is it oliguria despite going up? Is it a certain volume that you're infusing into the patient per hour? What's your threshold to start renal replacement therapy?
I think all of those things. We are generous users of FFP for colloid at our burn center, and a lot of that has to do with Jeff Shepp's research on endotheliopathy and repair of the glycocalyx with FFP. So we use a lot of FFP. Used to be reactionary. We would do it when someone seemed like they were having a resuscitation that was going off the rails. Now we are more plasma inclusive in our resuscitation, meaning we started early before things go wrong. So I would say all the things that you mentioned, plus plasma not making a difference, is a real red flag for me. And just as we were talking about worsening acidosis. So the things that I pay a lot of attention to, if our acidosis is worsening, but say your hemoconcentration is getting better, you're giving them the fluid that they need, but it's not doing what you need it to do, then we're also pretty liberal CRRT users. We manage our own CRRT, so it's easy to pull the trigger.
Yeah, that's the same for me. It's going to be a terrible answer. Nobody's going to like it, but it's everything that you mentioned. I think you have to factor in all those different things. Your standard indications for dialysis or for CRRT and any critically ill patient, no matter the etiology of their illness. Also, for me, sometimes I'll calculate the IV index and I'll see, based on the volume that the patient's getting, if within 24 hours they're going to reach a threshold that compartments would be clearly endangered, then I will just go ahead and shut down the resuscitation. I think there's a lot of difference, burn surgeon to burn surgeon, on how we would do this. Even the partners that I've had, we all would do this a bit different. I don't think that it, now that I'm several years into practice, I don't think that it bothers me quite as badly to start patients on CRRT earlier, particularly with a difficult resuscitation and somebody who's got a high body surface area or a moderate body surface area burn plus an inhalation injury. In particular, these patients who have renal dysfunction, you know, the baseline, who are then injured, I think it just muddies the water even more. Rather than overload these patients and then reap the consequences from the pulmonary complications, the tissue complications, I would rather go ahead and start early RRT than give these patients outlandish volumes.
Fluid creep is a real problem, and fluid begets more fluid. And like you said, with a different provider walking through, giving a bolus every time there's something going on, it certainly can be problematic with the patient. Thanks for commenting on that. So we've talked about the difficult resuscitation, CRRT triggers. What about when a few days out, we start to see them become febrile? We start to see them become stable, their white counts going up. When do you say now they have burn wound infection? Or when do you say, hey, we need to take a look at these dressings again, or take these dressings down because we need to go to the operating room? There's something going wrong. Because as we know, burn shock and burns can elicit a massive inflammatory response that can sort of mimic sepsis in terms of a white count and a fever. And so what are your triggers to say, hey, there's something else going on, this patient might be infected?
I think importantly, that's not going to happen early. So if you have stuff that looks like sepsis in the first day or two, it's generally something else unless someone came in infected. But you're right. Eventually, nearly every big burn gets a burn wound infection that begets a pneumonia or a bloodstream infection, because ultimately all of this stuff is coming from the wounds, right? I tell residents this all the time, that all the things come back to the wounds, and the only way that someone survives and gets out of the burn unit is with wound closure. And all of the stuff that we battle between point A and point Z comes back to the wounds. It really does. Things that I look for that aren't maybe textbook or stuff that folks who don't pay attention to or don't take care of burn patients would think of is ileus. The first time someone has an ileus is usually an early sort of indicator that something's about to go off the rails. And so if I've got a patient who all of a sudden is mounting a fever and has an ileus, those are times that I'll often pull the trigger and send cultures and have a very close eye. I don't usually empirically start antibiotics until we have more results. So if I have a fever and an ileus, I'm not necessarily pulling the trigger. But if you then add hypotension to that, then a lot of times we'll empirically start. We're very narrow when we start antibiotics. We use a lot of nafcillin as long as we can, because if you start big early, you run out of things. So we do a lot of that here. Other sort of weird things that pop up for brewing infection that may not be evident on your labs or cultures yet, a big swollen scrotum is a weird first indicator that someone's about to show you their first signs of sepsis. And that's always a funny thing to teach learners or new nurses, that it's not just fluid overload a lot of times. But I find that ileus, delirium, and swollen scrotum are some of these sort of weird pre-sepsis markers that pay a lot of attention to.
Yeah, there's some papers that have proposed a specific burn-specific set of criteria to trigger sepsis, workups, and that sort of thing. I think the body of evidence for that is a bit of a moving target, but some centers do invoke some of those criteria that are more burn-specific. I try to, like Karen said, I try to ask for critical care team where if I'm doing an IC that week, I try to get providers to not think so much about infection within the first 48 to 72 hours. Once they hit that kind of 72-hour mark, I think all bets are off. They very well could be their lungs, wounds even. I think I could speak for most modern high-volume burn centers to say that I think that we much more aggressively treat surgical wounds earlier than we used to, even when I was really a fellow. We would sometimes wait 3 or 3 days for their resuscitation to be over for the papillary leak to essentially seal, whether you believe that or not. And I really have no issue going to the operating room for the first excision of several, even if they're still on the tail end of their active resuscitation. Terry's practice may be a little different than that, but I worry less about the wounds now than I probably ever have at any point, just because I know how well the wounds are excised. I think we're a lot earlier the spectrum of days to get wounds off, to get burns off.
What about central access? How do you guys manage central venous lines, and do you change them routinely?
Yeah, that's how I learned to put in central lines when I was medical student and an intern. We still rotate the central lines in the burn, so I went to the changeover wire technique back in the day. We had the book, and everybody got a new line every 7 days or whatever it was. So now I do not routinely rotate lines. I think that line care is extremely important. When I see a dirty CHG impregnated silver dressing that's just filled with blood, old blood, brown stuff, I try to just drill into the team to watch out for that. Be very vigilant about line care. I don't know that there's a perfect method for overloading your line insertion sites. I've tried it all, CHG, silver, hydrothera blue. I think I've almost all of it. I never like sticking through a burn or through an open wound, but sometimes I need these huge CVSA patients. There just isn't another option. So whenever an area is closed, whether that's a recent site or whether it's a donor site that's got spray on skin cells or whatever, anytime that an area pops open that's available that isn't through an open wound, then I preferentially try to get a durable central access to that site.
Yeah, we are still line changers. We don't wire them, but we're new stick every 3 days. Yeah. And we'll stick through burn. We just put silvadine on top of the line.
Sam brought up a really good point in terms of family discussions and with these big burns. We all know that these big burns are a marathon and mortality is high. How do you, burn patient comes in, an initial burn debridement happens, you're introducing yourself, I'm the burn surgeon this week, this is what we've got. What do you tell patients? What do you tell patients' families in the ICU who are coming to you severely burned?
I think you have to break it up into chunks. These families, 99 times out of 100, have no prior exposure to what we're dealing with. There's not usually much of a recidivism situation in burn. And so this is all brand new. I find that talking to them about the long game is usually futile in the first meeting, and maybe even a little bit cruel, right? So I tell them the first 24 hours here is its own mountain that we have to climb and get through. And that's what we're going to focus on right now. And if we are successful in getting through this next 24 hours, then we've got to talk about the first operation. And as Max said, sometimes that happens within the tail end of that first 24 hours. But I try to break it up into chunks for them. And I have always found that it is more beneficial to be blunt and realistic with people than it is to maybe false hope. And so I tell them the most scary survival chance that we have, because I don't want someone to come to us 48 hours later and say, we didn't know. Also, because you sometimes lose people a month in, 2 months in, and they need to have known at the very beginning that it's a very long road, but that all we can really concentrate on right now is this first chunk, and then we'll keep talking to you as you go. And then I always try to make sure that they understand that even if this doesn't go well, the one thing I can control in a situation where there sometimes are few things you can control is somebody's pain and anxiety. That I've always got the ability to help with that, even if the rest of it falls off the rails. So I try to give them that so that they have something they can hang on to.
Yeah, that's extremely well said. Lens is more as far as information goes, because they are just going to get into a phase of sensory overload really quickly as far as family goes. I usually advise people to invoke their support networks early. If they have family who live out of state, call them and see if I'm visiting better. I try to take care of people as best we can as far as family members go. While they're in the hospital, we get a lot of family members who just will not leave for any reason. And I try, especially after the first day or two, to just encourage them and to use resources available within the hospital to get some rest, to do hygiene, pay the bills, feed the dog. Because at the end of the day, if I get their loved one out of the hospital, all these things are still going to be playing into their loved one's future life. A lot of people ask very early on, what is this going to look like in 6 months? I'm just kind of blunt with people now after I've done this a while. I say everything scars, no matter how severe or how seemingly minor. But our focus really is on this first phase of first resuscitation, surviving the first couple of days, then the first, second, maybe third excision. And then once we get to a point where we've survived all of that and the patient's doing well, then we'll go and shift into more of a reconstructive or at least a building up phase, where instead of just taking away, we're jumping into the operating room, we're actually, you know, rebuilding with the intent of covering the patient's wounds to get them out of the hospital.
Are there any tools y'all use to help guide expectations around mortality?
There's a nice revised Bose score nomogram that I keep in my office. It's actually from a Journal of Trauma article in 2010, Osler and team, that has it graphically. And it's, of course, not black and white, but it'll give you on both sides, this is this really nice graphic, a scale on either side of patient's age, if they do or don't have an inhalation injury, and you draw a line and it gives you a cut and dry, what does mortality look like? And I like to remind myself of that. So I'm talking in at least somewhat data-driven numbers. And then the things that don't factor into these models that Katie Romanowski in Sacramento has done a really good job of starting to explore is frailty, as we see more and more old people come in with big burns because they fell in the shower or lit their sleeve on fire, whatever. Those sorts of things that we aren't accounting for in just plain old age plus inhalation injury really matter. And she's doing a lot of good work trying to characterize how we can account for frailty and what's the best way to do it, and how does that inform what we should even be pushing for, et cetera, et cetera. But those things don't at this moment factor into our traditional mortality calculators.
Yeah, I agree. Frailty is a big one. And if we can establish how frail someone was at the beginning, earlier on in their hospital course, especially with a severe injury, I think that can help factor into conversations moving forward about goals of care, what the outcome we all would expect is going to be. I think that's extremely important. I find that I typically use the scoring system, like the revised Bose score, when I'm trying to steer patients' families toward a really tough decision or toward a poor outcome, similar to the NISQIP surgical risk calculator. With the resident or fellow, I only printed that thing out and showed it to the patient's families. But I was advising them strongly to not go through with the X-lab or parchment blood in here or whatever. So I find that I use the revised bow more often when I'm trying to impart to a family the heightened risk of mortality or significant morbidity or outcome.
Nutrition. We know that burns require a significant amount of calories, from protein, et cetera. Sometimes this can be a little difficult to actually get the calories if patients are going back to the operating room every other day and you have to be NPO. How do you guys manage your tube feeds, especially in these big burn patients who have to go prone in the operating room? Are you stopping tube feeds at a certain time before the operation and sucking out the stomach, or do you keep it going? How are y'all managing those? Because I think that's a hot topic. It can be difficult to get them the calories that they need.
Yeah. I think this is where a multidisciplinary team is absolutely essential for successful burn care. We have a very dedicated dietitian who keeps very close tabs on how we're doing feeding our patients. We are very lucky to have beat down the wall of NPO before every surgery. I know that not every burn center has accomplished this, and it takes a lot of groundwork to achieve, but we have three specific circumstances in which patients are NPO before the operating room and none others. And those are a patient who needs to be intubated, so someone who isn't showing up to the OR with an airway, in a circumstance of needing to be prone, which you mentioned, and if we're tracking somebody. So those are the only circumstances in which we hold feeds before the OR. So that's helped us cut down a lot on these preoperative nutritional deficits. And it's interesting because that's actually not the case everywhere in the hospital. We've somehow achieved a carve out for burn patients, which we're very thankful for. And outside of those three circumstances, luckily we don't have to go prone a whole lot. We use lateral positioning as much as we can to avoid that specific circumstance. And then judging how we're doing, we use indirect calorimetry where we can. We use 24-hour UUNs to estimate nitrogen needs. And then the other sort of basic from the bedside test is looking at someone's donor sites. If they're not healing their donor sites, that's often an indication that either they're infected or not getting enough nutrition. So that's the poor man's way that we use it.
That's all extremely good and well said. Airway manipulation is the big one at my institution, both for an informer that would trigger a 2-feet hold prior to the operating room. Just people getting an airway or people getting a trach manipulation of any sort. Prone, if they're fed post-war, for an institution, we don't hold feeds. Typically, sometimes they end up getting held in air just because that is a common one, where I know other services insist that nutrition be held prior to the OR. The biggest area, at least in critical care, that I find where patients lose a lot of their nutritional, at least volume of feeds, assuming they're tolerating volumes. We aren't a bolus feeding institution at the moment, but we do have a hybrid approach where often at the end of the day, one of the dietitians will go by and they'll calculate exactly what the volume of enteral feed administered for the day was. And if there's a deficit that's more than 10%, from what they need, based on what they got, then they'll actually make that up in the form of a bolus. So that's Monday through Friday, the dietitians in house. That's actually a good way to gain some of that nutrition. One of the things being in the ICU a lot, particularly recently, is nurses hold 2 feeds in the ICU for a variety of things. We have some nurses who hold 2 feeds for 30 minutes before they go in and turn a patient, or like deep suction a patient. People hold 2 feeds forever before an extubation. So that's the constant thing that I think re-educate the staff. And we still have some providers who really check gastric residuals and hang their hat on not having a gastric residual above 600 mils and so forth. So I think there are a lot of things at play, especially if you have a lot of turnover with ICU nurses or providers, or you have a multidisciplinary critical care team where it's not always one of your critical care specific people doing the ICU care. I think people lose out on a lot of volume of nutrition just on a routine daily basis.
Kind of back up a little bit. We were talking on terms of mortality about inhalation injury. I'd like to explore that topic a little bit more. How do you guys initially diagnose your inhalation injuries? how is your initial management when in terms of vent management for those more severe patients that are intubated? And then we can start there and maybe discuss some more advanced therapies for inhalation injury.
You guys are asking all this stuff that doesn't have a straightforward answer, and luckily stuff that have ongoing trials that will provide us data and answers in the coming years. We've gone back and forth on diagnostic bronchoscopies for inhalation injury, and it's a little bit before I started. I trained here, so I was here, but before I started as an attending, there was not a whole lot of bronchoscopy going on. And then shortly after I started, we started wanting to do them on everybody so that we could attach a grade of inhalation injury to somebody who came in and then have an idea of how that progressed. And there is some value and utility to that, having an idea of tracheal erythema and or sloughing, depending on how severe it is, edema. And so you can grade inhalation injury in a rudimentary fashion. And then watching that for a couple of days and seeing if that's getting better or not. So we did that a lot for a while and then fell out of favor with it a little bit, not because we consciously decided not to, but in the back of my mind started wondering if instrumenting people early on was just going to introduce bacteria earlier and hasten their ventilator-associated pneumonia that would eventually come. And so I started stepping back a little bit and trying to decide, is this really necessary? My partners and I were just talking about this a week ago, and I think the answer is still not clear. How useful is early bronchoscopy? We know in someone with a real inhalation injury, bronchoscopy becomes therapeutic eventually, right? They start sloughing their mucosa and you need it. But I don't know how useful it is early on, and I don't think we know. Luckily, there are some other lung injury imaging studies happening right now. We're lucky to get to participate in one that's looking at ultrasound findings of inhalation injury. And believe it or not, there are some substantial ones. And so we're doing more bronchoscopy now, mostly to be able to correlate seeing on ultrasound. As everybody knows, chest x-ray is pretty useless for inhalation injury, especially early on. So that's how we're approaching at least the imaging procedural part of it.
Yeah, super controversial topic. Usually at meetings, if this gets discussed very often, it usually gets heated in a fun way. People feel so passionately about it. I've done it both ways with Terrence. Jerry did an institution where we bronched everyone for diagnostic purposes. Now my practice has shifted really that I don't really bronch unless it's for therapeutic reason. The caveat to that is if I do have a difficult resuscitation, I've ticked off all the other things that I'm really concerned about, associated trauma, so forth and so on. If the history is unclear, history of the injury is unclear, and that sort of thing, I will sometimes just throw a bronch down if it's little denied. Just to say, oh yeah, that's a high grade inhalation injury. We didn't previously have that information. And if that bronch is negative, the negative predictive value for me is a little more useful than the positive value. Otherwise, history slash mechanism really important in these patients. Try to elicit that. If they have risk for it, then typically treat them empirically for it. And all these patients are going to get blood protective ventilatory strategies if they're in distress, if they have significant facial burns, or they get a definitive airway early on. Typically, if the patient's going to go on an airway algorithm or an inhalation algorithm, I'll go ahead and start venulitis, mucolytics, and then just stress the importance to the ICU team of pulmonary toilets. Beyond that, I don't think anything for me is set in stone.
And then for the patients that do find themselves in an ARDS picture, I'm curious if you guys use this tool as well. We are big fans of goal-directed PEEP and ventilator pressures and use esophageal manometry for that. It's really eye-opening. And a lot of these patients, they need 20, 23 of PEEP to avoid atelectasis trauma and all of these things. And so it's been really helpful to guide both what we set for our PEEP, what we need to do for our volumes, and figuring out what plateau pressures you can tolerate, which oftentimes are way outside of what people are normally comfortable with. And so we've really enjoyed having that extra set of data that we can get for esophageal manometry when we have folks who do have difficult to manage lung injury.
Yeah, I've not used that tool before. We don't have that available, but that sounds like a great way. There are all kinds of ways. Some of the newer ventilator technologies have some different methods for trying to calculate based on volumes and pressures and so forth, optimal Ps and so forth. So we'll occasionally factor in some of those more automatic reports from the ventilator. But I think higher PEEP, lower total volume, really aggressive pulmonary spoilage, try to limit fluids within reason as much as we can. I'm fairly quick to prone patients unless they just have contraindications to be prone, just nothing else to improve oxygenation.
That was one benefit to the COVID pandemic is everyone got really comfortable with proning.
Yeah.
So you guys mentioned the mucolytics and nebulizers and stuff like that. What about anything with inhaled heparin? Is that still a thing? Has that gone away?
It is still a thing. Lacks amazing science. Our cocktail is N-acetylcysteine, heparin, albuterol, and hypertonic saline. We usually set that up for 48 hours in someone who we suspect has true inhalation injury. And then at 48 hours, I reevaluate whether we need to continue that or not. That can be based on bronchoscopy. It can be based on their physiology and a lot of times based on what's in the suction canister. If they still have a lot of soot coming up, then they often can benefit from doing that another 24 to 48 hours to elevate all that out.
So do you have a threshold when you start thinking about ECMO for your inhalation patients, or is it similar to they're failing proning, you're doing all these other measures, or does the burn complicate the decision for ECMO also?
So we have a pretty strongly established ECMO team at this hospital. We can physically cannulate them, but the team itself manages a lot of that. And I'm trying to remember off the top of my head what their sort of box checking is. And so they have a dot phrase when they write their notes that X, Y, and Z things were met for us to consider or not consider a patient for ECMO. And so I would say once, maybe twice a year, this comes up for us, luckily, in a fairly high volume center. So luckily we don't have to do this very often, but it is more often than not in a young person who is just either not oxygenating or ventilating. I've had it for ventilation as well, despite all the things that you just said, proning, lung protective strategy, CRRT, making them really dry. And if that stuff all fails, then that's usually when they'll seriously consider them. We had one patient in the last 12 months, I can't remember exactly how long ago it was, who was not even rescuable by ECMO. Young guy, bad car crash, both traumatic and burn injuries, and luckily we're a level one trauma center as well. And he had a lot of those things dealt with, but had a cardiac output that was just not matchable with the ECMO and really was not salvageable in that way, which was a huge bummer. So occasionally it works out, but usually a burn who has to go to ECMO is a long shot. We'll do it, but luckily don't have to very often.
Yeah, I was just trying to think. I believe 3 or 4 times have I actually had patients go on pump in the last 4 years, two kids to adults. Yeah, so fortunately it's rare. I think my threshold for calling the ECMO team and firing off the console is lower than it used to be when I first came into practice. I will call them, and someone who is going through my algorithm of escalating vent settings, I'm prone to PF ratios, a lot of improving. Especially like Taryn said, if I'm having a ventilation issue in particular, I will call them earlier just to put them on the team's radar so that they are actively checking labs and rounding on the patient, factoring in. And some of those docs are just really, really smart individuals and have different ideas about vent and bones and have some maneuvers and some things that they want to try before you get to that point of no return. And, you know, many times you can avoid actually having to cannulate the patient. That's my line of thinking. The last time I heard a presentation, I believe it was an abstract last year on like outcomes and burn plus ECMO, it was about equivalent to all the other causes for ECMO as far as mortality goes. Get the database and the ELSA database, like 50-50.
And in your ARDS patients, are y'all using steroids adopted from the DEXA ARDS? Yeah. Sam, do you have any other questions? Maybe you guys want to hit on the topic of maybe DVT prophylaxis, when to hold it related to the burn, when to continue it. What's your guys' practice? Do you check anti-10A level?
Yeah, probably 12, 18 months ago, started using anti-10A as our benchmark for how to dose DVT prophylaxis. We were for many years a once daily enoxaparin dosing burn center, and then had a couple VTEs that were alarming and not as expected for people who were continuously getting their DVT prophylaxis. We don't hold it for the operating room. I don't hold it for somebody bleeding. I strongly feel like if someone's bleeding substantially. It's a hemostasis problem, not a DVT prophylaxis problem. And so we really don't hold it for that. When we had a couple of those VTEs, we looked at our practice and have transitioned to an enoxaparin 40 milligrams twice a day standard, unless somebody is underweight, poor renal function, elderly, pregnant, et cetera. And then we titrate, rather adjust our dosing, I guess is probably the better way to say it, based on anti-TNA. And we are targeting usually 0.2 to 0.4. So we time after the third dose, check that, and go up or down as needed. So that's our standard, obviously with carve-outs for some of the things that I mentioned.
Similar at my institution, we use TNAs on extremes of weight in either direction, renal failure, or other special circumstances. Otherwise, it's a dosing of the prophylactic levonorgestrel as standard. Like Taryn, we don't hold for anything. Should use a stitch or cautery at the bedside or whatever it may be. I'd rather deal with that than a PTE or the patient having to go on to be in full population acutely.
Great. Well, thank you all so much for being here. Thank you for your time. Thanks for discussing all the ins and outs as much as possible of critical care for the burn patient. Thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
That wraps up another episode of TraumaCast, brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Visit east.org to check out all the great educational and career development resources we have to offer. And make sure you subscribe to the TraumaCast series so you don't miss any of our exciting upcoming programs or interviews. If you're searching for cutting-edge science, professional education, networking, and career development, remember, all you need to do is look to the east.